Welcome back. We're diving into this Bank of England working paper on machine learning at central banks, specifically looking at Chakraborty and Joseph's staff working paper number 674 from 2017.
It's an interesting overview, especially how they frame machine learning as these two megatrends converging: advanced modelling and the explosion of granular, big data. But what's the real takeaway for central banks here? Is it just about having more data?
The paper suggests it's far more than just volume. They highlight new responsibilities central banks acquired post-crisis, like market oversight and supervision, which came with a wealth of new, granular data sources. Think transaction-level data or detailed balance sheets. It's about how you use that data.
But then they immediately introduce this distinction. Machine learning traditionally excels at prediction, tracing strong correlations, whereas central banking and policy analysis usually revolve around causal inference. That seems like a pretty fundamental disconnect, doesn't it?
They address that. They argue that a general policy problem often has both a prediction and a causal inference component. For instance, predicting drops in income during a financial turmoil, given certain capital requirements, is a prediction task. The effect of those capital requirements on the economy is the causal part.
I'm not convinced that fully resolves the issue. If ML models are primarily good at prediction and causal inference remains an open research question for advanced ML, then how much can central banks truly rely on them for policy formulation, which demands understanding why things happen?
That's a fair challenge. The authors suggest ML and econometrics can be mutual extensions of each other, where ML handles the prediction side, and traditional econometric tools can still be used for causal inference or even influence new ML inference techniques being developed. They aren't saying throw out econometrics entirely.
So it's more about enriching the existing toolbox rather than replacing it. I can see that. But when we talk about this big data, they mention the five Vs: velocity, variety, volume, veracity, and value. Isn't there a huge risk with things like privacy and selection bias when dealing with such granular, diverse data?
Absolutely. The paper explicitly states these are major concerns, especially with anonymized microdata where cross-sections can still identify individuals or firms. And selection bias is critical. Online market data for a product might not represent the overall market.
Wait, why is standardization of features such a crucial point for some ML models? They mention techniques combining inputs, like neural networks, are sensitive to differences in numerical ranges. What does that really mean?
It means if one feature has values from 1 to 1,000 and another from 0 to 1, the larger range might unfairly dominate the learning process. Standardizing them, like using Z-scores, brings them to a comparable scale, so no single feature disproportionately influences the model's calculations. It makes the model fairer, essentially.
That makes sense. Now, let's talk about the models themselves. The paper outlines supervised and unsupervised learning. Supervised sounds like traditional modeling where you have a target variable. But what's the real benefit of unsupervised learning for central banks if there's no predefined target?
Unsupervised learning aims to find hidden structure in data, like grouping observations through clustering. For central banks, this could mean segmenting financial institutions based on their balance sheet characteristics or identifying types of fintech startups based on funding patterns. It can reveal previously unknown relationships or stylized facts, which can then inform policy or become features for supervised models.
That doesn't seem right. If you're just finding patterns without a specific question, couldn't you just find spurious correlations? How do you ensure the discovered structures are meaningful and not just random noise?
That's where interpretation and domain knowledge come in. They mention evaluating the sensibility of assignments for clustering. And you're right, it's a critical point. It's not just about what the algorithm finds, but what a human expert makes of it and if it's reproducible and relevant to the problem.
Moving to supervised models, they list quite a few. Naive Bayes, K-nearest neighbors, decision trees, random forests, neural networks, support vector machines, that's a lot. Do they suggest one is universally best?
No, quite the opposite. They state there's no single best method for a given problem in most cases and refer to the flat maximum effect, where different models might perform equally well. The choice depends on the dataset and the specific situation.
I'm intrigued by the idea of random forests outperforming single decision trees. The paper says it reduces variance because the trees are roughly independent. Wait, why are they only roughly independent if they're random? Doesn't random imply true independence?
They're built from random subsamples of the data and random subsets of features at each split. But they're still ultimately derived from the same underlying data, which introduces some positive pairwise correlation, hence roughly independent. The benefit comes from aggregating many slightly imperfect, diverse models.
And what about artificial neural networks? They call them one of the most powerful statistical learning algorithms and at the forefront of current developments in artificial intelligence. But aren't these the ultimate black boxes that policymakers would struggle to trust?
They acknowledge that interpretability is a potential problem, but they suggest ways to gain insight, like thinking of them as creating complex truth tables to represent patterns, or looking at the weight structure to understand which variables play a more important role. It's about finding ways to do model forensics, as they call it in the case studies.
Model forensics sounds like a necessary but perhaps retroactive solution. It's not giving you direct economic intuition up front. For a central bank making critical policy decisions, isn't that a significant drawback? You can't just say, the model said so.
You're right. Direct intuition isn't always there. But the paper suggests starting with smaller, simpler neural networks and only increasing complexity as needed, following Occam's razor. This helps maintain some level of interpretability. Plus, they emphasize that these models excel at identifying complex, nonlinear relationships that traditional econometric models might miss entirely.
What about support vector machines? The paper describes them using maximal margin and kernel trick to handle nonlinear separability. Is that fundamentally different from how a neural network approximates nonlinear functions?
Both are powerful at nonlinearity, but the approach is different. SVMs project data into a higher dimensional space where it might become linearly separable, then find the optimal hyperplane with the largest margin. Neural networks learn nonlinear relationships through multiple layers of activated neurons. One transforms the feature space. The other learns a hierarchical combination of simpler functions within it.
So, if central banks are going to adopt these tools, they need to understand these underlying differences and not just treat them as interchangeable black boxes.
Precisely. The paper concludes by stressing the need for an interdisciplinary approach, combining domain knowledge with technical expertise. It's not about which tool is best, but how to effectively combine them to address complex economic problems.
That makes a lot of sense. Thanks for breaking this down.
My pleasure.